The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
You can be in the middle of a hurricane, or you can be on a calm day. North is still north. You could be in a thunderstorm. North is still north. People can yell at you. North is still north. It doesn't change fundamental things. And in this business, right is still right, even if you stand by yourself.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That audio, by the way, was Justice Clarence Thomas talking about the need to stand up for what is right, even if you're standing alone. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court today. We're going to talk about a number of really good issues today, but the Supreme Court is definitely going to be one of them. We'll be speaking with Joe Kennedy, the coach whose termination was under scrutiny by the Supreme Court and who won the case yesterday. We'll talk to him and his attorney a little bit about that in the next hour. But joining us right now is our friend Paul Auster. He's the CEO of Better Qualified LLC, a company that specializes in business and consumer credit services. He is an expert on how the major credit bureaus operate and a professional speaker at financial and banking conferences. You can find out more at betterqualified.com. Paul, great to talk to you today. And it sounds like we may have lost Paul. He's going to call back, I'm sure, in just a moment. One of the things that we're going to be discussing with Paul is the issues of credit delinquencies in car loans. And this is beginning to be an issue. John Lawler, who's the chief financial officer of Ford Motors, was saying 2 weeks ago that this is perhaps a leading indicator of where the economy is going to be going over the next couple of years. Is this rise in car loan delinquencies? I think we have Paul back on the line. Paul Auster, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Ed.
Well, Paul, it's always good to talk to you. And this is, we're hearing a lot about economic indicators. We're going to talk about more about that later in the show, too. But, you know, interest rates are going up. Inflation is eroding buying power at the same time. It's a bad time maybe to get into car loans for some Americans, but it's still bad even if you're in a car loan and your buying power is eroding. And I was just mentioning that John Lawler, the CFO of Ford Motors, was saying that a rise in car loan delinquencies may be a leading indicator of trouble in the economy. You want to talk a little bit about what the dynamics are there?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is one of the, you know, precursors to a downturn in the economy. So you have credit card delinquencies are on the rise, auto financing and leasing payment, late payments are on the rise. And that's because, look, those are the things that we tend to start missing the payments first. Utilities, these are what consumers say, I have to pay my mortgage because I don't want to get evicted, right? Or I have to pay my rent. So these other bills are the ones that tend to be the first ones that we start to miss on when we're being pinched. So this is a real, again, unfortunately, good indication that consumers are in trouble.
Well, and I don't think that anybody's going to be very surprised to hear consumers are in trouble, right? There's some tension here, though, because there are some people who are going to argue, and I think that there's an arguable position here, that the economy is actually doing pretty well when you're looking at employment. Now, I think that's a little overstated because we're still below the number of jobs that we had in the economy in February 2020. And of course, we've had some population growth since then, so we should have been creating more jobs. But we really have actually, what's a good word for that, recovered almost all of the jobs that we actually did lose in the pandemic shutdowns. You have a fairly low number of people who are applying for initial weekly jobless claims. And the unemployment rate, which I think is probably a little understated because I think there's an overhang of workers that haven't gotten back into the workforce yet, but that number is historically pretty good. It's at least close to full employment if the number holds out. So you wouldn't normally expect these types of issues to be happening now. So first off, are those assumptions poor assumptions? And then B, what might be driving this?
I don't think they're poor assumptions, but you know, you used a word that we can't use right now, and that's normally. Nothing right. is normal about the current landscape and environment that we're in. This is unprecedented times. We've never had all of these pillars in place, so it's really hard for anybody to forecast what's going to happen. The reality is, you know, let's face it, we were living in a 0% interest rate for a very long time. We can't do that. At some point, we have to pay, right? So right. here we are, we're starting to pay. I think the Fed, you know, waited a little bit too long, and maybe now it's a case of a little too late. But as consumers, we're the ones that get pinched at this point, right? So, and this is where I become probably the most unpopular guy in the room. We have to hold ourselves accountable, because if we weren't preparing for the rainy day during the good times, right? So we had 0% interest rate. Did we pay down our credit card debt? Did we try and eliminate other debt? Did we start saving for the rainy day? You know, there was a time where we used to talk about having a 3 to 6 month reserve of emergency funds. Well, I think we now know after the pandemic, that needs to be 12, 18, 24 month reserve. So I'm not saying that we need to panic, but consumers better hold themselves accountable. They better have a game plan, you know, to weather the storm here. And one of the easiest things to do, believe it or not, maybe it's not easy, but it's not complicated. Get out of credit card debt as soon as possible. You have to figure out a way to do that. Again, might not be easy. It might hurt a little bit, but it's certainly not complicated, because once you do that, once you eliminate revolving credit card debt that, you know, right now the average is 17-18%, and those rates are directly tied to the Fed rate. So every time the Federal Reserve raises rates, we hear about it all the time now, that every time they've met recently, they're raising the rates again. So when they raise those rates, all of our credit interest rates. So those rates are ticking up. So it's gonna actually take a little bit more buying power to pay down your debt. So get it in place, get that household budget taken care of. Look, as a family, sit down and figure this out, because we're all on a fixed income. So where's the money going to come from? The money's gonna have to come from cutting expenses. And we've become a nation of subscriptions. Hulu, Spotify, Netflix, Sirius, right. Roblox, you know, all of these crazy things. And that could cost the average family $100-$300 a month in these subscriptions. So I'm not saying you have to do it forever. Now is the time. If your kids are old enough, get them working papers. Get them out there. There are jobs available. They're now saying there's two jobs for every person on unemployment. So maybe you get them, you know, into the workforce sooner than you'd like, but if they're old enough, why not? Maybe now is the time to get yourself a second job and second income. So we have to be disciplined. We have to kind of buckle down here, and you have to do it now, right? Because if we just sit on our hands and hope for the best, hope, oh, I heard President Biden might forgive student loans. Oh, I heard they're going to do this, and I heard they're going to do that. If you're waiting for that, those are the people that are really going to get caught, you know, on the short end of the stick.
We are speaking with Paul Auster of BetterQualified.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And look, I mean, I think we're talking about this as though we are in a recession. We're not there yet. Maybe we're talking about this like we're not even close to a recession, though. Maybe if you think about it a different way, when you're talking about people who aren't planning, who think that, you know, they're going to be able to get by with this, that inflation is you know, going to be temporary and things will level off here. First off, whatever inflation impact that we've had is going to stick around already. What we're hoping to do is not add to it with more inflation after this. Otherwise, you're talking about deflation, which is a whole other economic problem altogether. The second part of that, though, is that whether or not you agree with it, whether or not you think it's necessary, the Federal Reserve is tightening the money supply, and that usually is going to lead to some sort of recessionary environment in which some of those jobs that you're talking about are simply going to evaporate because there just won't be enough business, enough consumer spending to sustain it. And we're already seeing some retreat on consumer spending. It's monthly data right now, so it's not a broad enough look at it, but we're seeing those signals. So really, I think your warning here is even more timely. If you're going to do something about restructuring your situation, your credit situation, so that you're better able to weather these things, the very first thing you have to do is get rid of the revolving credit. That doesn't help people on the car loans directly, but it certainly leaves them more money so that they don't get sideways or upside down on those car loans.
That's right. That's right. And there's lots of, you know, besides just eliminating the debt, where every dollar you put towards revolving debt, it's like getting let's call it a 20% return on your money, because you're not paying 20% on that dollar the following month. And let's not forget, when you pay down your credit card debt, your credit scores go up. So maybe it puts you in a position to refinance that car loan. You know, maybe you extend it out a little bit, but you could drive the monthly payment down. Maybe you sell it and get into a different car. But if your credit score is low right now, if it's below, if you're not in the 700 club, now you're really setting yourself up for some problems. Our credit scores are going to cost or save us money every single month. All interest rates are directly tied to your credit score. And a lot of consumers don't realize your insurance premiums are directly tied to your credit. They don't call it a credit score. They call it an insurance score. It's the same number. It comes from the same data. So figure out a way to get out of credit card debt. Take a look at your personal credit right now. Figure out what you have to do to improve your credit, because that will help you weather the storm.
Paul, when people are, I want to get back to this credit score thing here for just a little bit, because it's interesting how much that's insinuated in other parts of our finance. And it's one of those, it's sort of one of those murky details, I think, that people just don't comprehend. So I think maybe in order to get this right, I mean, people should know what goes into that credit reporting, what doesn't go into that credit reporting that develops that score. What are the behaviors that this is going to measure?
Yeah, that's a great, you know, point, because the average consumer doesn't understand exactly what goes into a credit report. And fortunately or unfortunately, one of the biggest myths out there is it has to do with your income. The credit bureaus and the FICO scoring model has nothing to do with your income, for better or worse, right?
Right.
But what it does have to do with, it's the number one payment, the number one factor in credit scoring is your payment history. Makes sense. You pay your bills on time, you're going to have a better credit score than someone who doesn't pay their bills on time. And that's based on, the first trigger is a 30-day late payment. So let's talk about the auto lates. If my car payment was due today and I didn't pay it, that's not a 30-day late. Now, I'm going to get whacked with a late fee, but that's not going to get reported to the credit bureaus as a negative event. If I fail to make that payment 30 days after today, most of the time the creditors are going to report that to the credit bureaus, a one-time 30-day late payment. You could pay that car payment. Let's say you had a five-year financing term. You paid it on time for 4 years and 11 months. You missed the last payment, and you don't pay it for 30 days. You could easily lose 25, 50, maybe 100 points off your credit score. So payment history is number one. The second factor is it's called your utilization ratio. The income is not a factor, but what the bureaus and the scoring model is based upon, how much credit do you have available and how much credit do you use? And this is where consumers get in trouble. As soon as you go over 30% balance to credit limit, your scores start to come down. 50%, 60%, your scores are plummeting. If you max out one credit card, if you go over the credit limit by $1, You could easily, again, 10, 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 points. You didn't make a late payment. You didn't go into collections, but you went over the credit limit by $1, easily lose 25, 30, 50 points maybe. So people have to understand, it's a great point that you're bringing up, because they don't really know. They hear about it, but how do they come up with my score? Payment history is number one. Utilization is number two. The third factor is your credit history. So this is where, again, people get mixed signals from, you know, people online. Oh, live debt free. Cut up your credit cards. Don't use credit cards. All that stuff sounds great, and maybe it makes sense from a financial planning standpoint.
Right.
But from your credit score, it's a really bad thing, right? Because the scoring model is based upon that monthly payment history, and the longer the history, the better off it is for your score. So if you have credit cards that have been open and inactive, keep them open and active, and pay them down below 30% every single month. Look, paying them off in full is the best, but if you can't do that, really set the goal to try and get those balances below 30% of the credit limits, and really talk to someone before you just close a credit card. Closing a credit card for the average person is a negative, will have a tremendous negative impact on their credit scores. The reason being, whatever available credit you had on that card, if it's still open, you have access to it. But if you do not, hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Paul. And so, I mean, just because what that does is it basically expands the, it expands the denominator, actually. If you have more credit that you're not using, it makes you look better in terms of your credit score than if you have a smaller pot. Yes, I get that.
But the problem is with credit history, people think, you know, especially if they're going to come up to a financing opportunity or situation, oh, before I buy a house or before I buy the car, before I refinance, I'm going to close some of these accounts because that's going to look good to the bank. It's really a bad thing, because you're losing that monthly payment history that's building the score. And for your credit cards, the day you close the account, it's taken out of your credit history. Those accounts have to be open and active from the day that you get the card. So do not close them. Don't close any credit cards without talking to somebody before you do it, because most of the time it will be a negative impact to your credit scores.
Paul, and again, we're speaking with Paul Oster of BetterQualified.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. In that same sense, you know, there are a lot of people who, when they get into a situation where they're overextended on credit cards, but they've got some significant equity, so that, you know, they have some value, they're not underwater. If you take a look at their entire financial picture, they will opt at that point to pull equity out to consolidate debt. Is that a smart strategy, especially maybe in this environment right now? Maybe this is the time to do it before interest rates get too high, or is that really not the best way to proceed?
No, I think, you know, right now, so people should only have a mortgage debt service, right? Some things are unavoidable, and if you want to buy a home, you know, I don't know too many people that could just pay cash outright, you know, for a home. So if you have a mortgage and you have some equity available and you have other debts that are out there, now would be a great time to do a cash out refinance and restructure your debt so that you're only carrying that mortgage. Look, even though the rates have jumped up dramatically over the past 6 months, they're still relatively low. I mean, you could get a 30-year fixed mortgage in the 5% range. So if you have credit card debt that's at 17, 20, 29%, it just makes sense mathematically to do that. And you get the tax benefits from having the mortgage. So really, it's a great time to take a look at restructuring your debt if you have equity available. You know, and some financial planners cringe when I say this, but it might be a time to look at taking a loan out against your some type of retirement vehicle, right? People are putting money into a 401k and getting a certain return on that money. But I mean, it's a good thing. You're saving for retirement. But if you're doing that while you're carrying credit card debt, you're shooting yourself in the foot, right? So
right.
Sit, maybe now is the time, you know, when we start to think about this. And I say it's not complicated, you know, it might not be easy, but it's sort of, maybe it is a little complicated, and I sometimes take it for granted. Look, reach out to a certified financial planner, a fee-based financial planner. It's worth every penny to have a professional look at your holistically, what you got going on, and then they can make some recommendations for you. But if you don't understand how it works, you know, figure it out sooner than later. Again, I suggest you sit down with the family and you say, hey, look, we're coming into tough times. And if we continue to do the same thing we've always done, we're going to be in trouble. So as a family, we're all going to make some sacrifices, right? And we don't have to do it forever. But over the next year, you know, I know, Johnny, you like to go to Starbucks and get a mocha frappuccino racket, whatever. You know, you're paying $8. You know, your kids are walking out of Starbucks paying $8, $10, $12 every single time. You know, you stopping at the convenience store. I always reference a book. It's called You're Broke Because You Want to Be. Right. So people, right. We kind of bury our heads in the sand. We live in a crisis mode every 30 days. But and we say, where did all my money go? And that's a very common situation where yes. Your money is going to the convenience store. The money is going to drinks and going out to dinner. The money is going to all those subscriptions. But if you don't know where it's going, you better sit down and figure it out and find out where it's going. Start plugging the holes immediately before the ship sinks.
We were speaking with Paul Auster. Let's go to the phones. Line one, Noel is on the line. She's got a question for us from Buda, Texas. Welcome.
Hi. I'm glad that I caught this part of the show because I am about to close on a home and take money from another sale and pay off all my credit card debt. But then my immediate next thing was going to shut down one of those Disney credit cards so that I didn't pay that monthly fee anymore. So,
right.
I mean, is it okay to just like shut down one? I mean, is that a really bad thing? Because it's like $100 a year.
Well, so it's going to depend question. Upon how many other open active accounts you do have. Is that the oldest credit card? What is the age of that card? You know, versus the other cards. And if you close a credit card, you know, what's really important is that you do not open another credit card very soon thereafter, because now you've completely changed the average age, let's call it, history of all of your credit cards, because it's cumulative, right? So just be careful about closing the card.
Noel, thank you very much for that call. It's a great question, and I think it tied right into what it was that you were telling us earlier, Paul, about making sure that you understand how that credit is structured. You know, we've got about a minute left, and I'm going to ask you to just kind of give people a sum up here of what it is that they we've already talked about a lot of what they should be doing as the economy starts to weather out. But if you are one of these people who are really on the edge with a car loan, and you need help with that, the first call really should be to the lender, right? Because usually the lenders are trying to figure out how to help people get through these passages.
Yeah, that's right. You know, a lot of people think it's the opposite, that they want you to fail and they want you to default. They don't need another default, right? So there are credit management programs available from the original creditors. There are some nonprofits out there that could help you with credit management, money management. And again, I think it's well worth your time to at least get the consultation and figure it out. But if you're starting to struggle, reach out to the creditors and figure out how you can work together so that you do not completely default on any loans, because then it becomes, you know, a tough situation.
And then, of course, you can always go to betterqualified.com to find out more about how people can work with their credit and how to manage their finances. And Paul Auster, of course, is CEO of Better Qualified, betterqualified.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Ed, thanks for having me on again.
Always great talking with you, Paul. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about energy policy. We'll be talking about where we're at, where we need to be, and what it is that we need to move forward in our future and do it responsibly. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 31 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. And we're going to talk a little energy here, a little energy policy, energy needs, energy responsibility, and how we tie all those together to get a rational path forward to meeting our goals over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years without the price shocks that we're seeing right now. Joining us to discuss that is David Holt. He's president of Consumer Energy Alliance. You can find that at consumerenergyalliance.org. He's got almost 30 years of experience working for state and federal agencies and Congress and directing outreach and advocacy efforts. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ed. How are you?
I am doing well. I work from home, so I don't have to go to the gas station a whole lot. I'm not doing as well as some other people, though, who have to commute to work every day and who are just getting hammered by the prices at the gas pump. You're seeing prices increase in the more controlled markets of electricity. Energy is just one of those inflationary factors, right, that just sort of multiply along distribution chains and really can start driving prices out of sight. And that's kind of what we've been seeing over the last year or so, right?
Exactly right. I mean, listen, even if you're staying home, you're seeing your electricity prices go up and it's kind of hitting you from all sides now. You can't escape it. And, you know, these prices were going up well before the situation in Ukraine started. It's a factor of kind of how we're regulating energy markets, how we're regulating refined goods, how we're slowing down access to oil and natural gas in this country. And it's a situation, I think you said it in the front end here, it's how do we come up with a rational energy policy that creates mechanisms where we have affordable energy that's reliable, that actually comes to us, and we don't have these risks of brownouts and blackouts that you're hearing more and more states talk about. And, you know, at the same time, we can continue the environmental progress that we're making. We can do all three of those things at the same time. It's just that we have too many policymakers and too many protesters out there that are trying to block pipelines, that are trying to block oil and gas development, that don't really have a good, solid understanding of where we're getting our energy and how much it means to all of us, particularly those that can't afford to pay more, those that are on fixed incomes, those that are living at or below the poverty level. It's those folks that I really worry about, and we should all really worry about, because they can't afford to pay $5 a gallon for gasoline or more for their electricity and to keep their home cool and things like that. That's a human health risk that we're looking at in addition to everything else.
Right. And I think that part of the reason why we don't come together on a rational policy, and I mean, just leaving the politics out of it, although I know politics is a very large part of this, is I think that there is a large gap of understanding about what are the components of gas price at the pump, right? Everybody understands that it's tied at least somewhat to the price of a barrel of oil, but there's more to it than that. What is it that constitutes a profit? You hear a lot about windfall profits, and when you go to dig into that, you find out that those are mostly mythological. On the other hand, you also find out that that there's a need for expansion, and that sometimes people just don't want to invest in that, and there are reasons for that as well. How much do you think those misunderstandings? I want to get into each of these a little bit with you, Dave, because I know that you're probably champing at the bit to explain them. How much of that do you think constitutes the frustration? I mean, how much of our frustration is just the fact that we just don't understand these things?
You know, I think there's just, you know, listen, we all have our daily lives and we're focused on our work and our family.
Right.
So unless the price of a gallon of gasoline gets to $4 and $5 a gallon, we're not really paying attention to it. It's just something that we do automatically. And you kind of almost, you know, zone out or look at your phone while you're filling up at the gas station, usually. But now we're sitting there watching that ticker go by, and many of us are taking pictures of that price of a fill-up because, you know, we want to send it out over social media and complain about it because it's front of mind, and it's literally you're feeling the money leave your pocketbook while you're filling up. But, you know, to answer your question now, you know, yes, the vast majority of that is the price of a barrel of oil. And we're seeing now the price of a barrel of oil is reaching historic highs. You also have the price of refining that barrel of oil into gasoline or diesel. Then you have the distribution over pipeline or truck to get it to where we are at the gas station. And then you have federal and state taxes on top of all that, those things. But the thing that we're looking at now, the fundamental issue we have now, is a supply problem.
Right.
The United States is the most energy-rich nation on Earth. And, you know, we're in many ways very pleased with energy diversity. We're seeing the rise of wind and solar to help meet our electricity needs. But for the traditional engine, the traditional car we're using today, that doesn't really offer us much help. So the only way to really affect change and affect the price and reliability of gasoline is to produce more oil here at home. We are an energy-rich nation. As I mentioned, we could easily produce more. We have a kind of a blockade of permits. We have a blockade on drilling and exploration and development in the Gulf of Mexico now that produces a large portion of our energy needs and oil needs here at home.
I believe it's 15% of our overall proven reserves, right? In the Gulf of Mexico, it's about 15-20%.
It is 15%, and that might sound like a low percentage.
No, but that's a large percentage. It's a very big chunk.
It's a large percentage, right? Exactly right. So it's a significant amount. So we've got to look at, and you know, until recently, the United States was the number one oil producer and the number one natural gas producer in the world. In December of 2019, we were producing about 13 million barrels a day of oil. Today, we're producing about 11.5, 11.7 million barrels a day. So the frustrating, confusing thing is why isn't the president and this administration calling in the oil and gas companies to say, hey, guys, listen, let's work together. How do we get that back up to 13 million barrels a day as quickly as possible? Let's send a signal to world energy markets that the United States is serious about its energy policy. Let's help put the downward price on a barrel of oil, which would immediately put a downward pressure on the price of gasoline and diesel. Why that conversation hasn't occurred is beyond me. It would be easy to have happen. There are probably some things that the federal government could do to expedite permits that would help the oil and gas industry. And I think the oil and gas industry is kind of, as they've stated repeatedly, they stand ready to help. And you mentioned windfall profits tax. I think that's another red herring that this administration has thrown out there, because it wasn't too long ago that oil prices were actually in the negative for a few days. So the amount of money it costs to drill and explore and diversify our energy resources is kind of astronomical. So we need to understand fully what's at play there.
Right. And again, we're speaking with David Holt and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. David Holt of Consumer Energy Alliance, consumerenergyalliance.org. You know, there's a couple things about that I want to step through. One is, you know, we were producing in December 2019. Of course, by March 2020, we had this massive shutdown because of the pandemic, which led to a massive collapse of demand. And that actually burned up a lot of the capital, right? A lot of these oil companies lost money. And when we talk about oil companies, another common misconception is that you've got maybe three or four or five different large oil companies that are operating businesses here in the United States, and that's simply not the case. There are thousands of these companies that some are focused on drilling, some are focused on you know, just working on the pipelines, or they're working on the platforms. There's thousands of companies that go into this. And when you have that demand destruction, that sort of dramatic demand destruction, it burns capital that you can't use later on because you've lost it. You've lost that money. And We had a similar trough in 2014. We had a similar demand trough in 2014, and a glut which really bankrupted some of the people who had been investing in it. Same thing happened in 2020. Nobody's fault. I mean, it's a pandemic's fault, and that means it's basically nobody's mm-hmm. fault. But it's just part of the reason why we're at where we're at. There's the capital. The capital that would normally go into those types of expansions, right? Even if you're assuming a fairly stable and tame regulatory structure, doesn't exist to some extent here. And it doesn't exist also because of some of the signals that's being sent about the future of the oil industry in the United States, which is part of what you're talking about here. And so the first thing you have to do, I think, is you have to reset the capital investment environment in order to get that capital investment.
You're exactly right, and I think that's kind of an underreported story. So at the same time, yep. you know, the energy companies by and large were responding to COVID and the downturn in the economy, as you talked about. There was a concerted effort among some state and federal and financial service sectors to reduce investment in the oil and gas industry, and
right,
to
this is the
create
ESG
mechanisms
moment.
where the investment opportunity and the investment appetite in oil and gas was diminished and was intentionally tried to get investors and others to look for other things to invest in, and that cycle continues to today. So looking at ways that you are expanding this capital, that you're looking for new frontiers in oil and natural gas, which, by the way, contributes 80% of our overall energy economy in this country, and it's been 80% for about 20 years, even as wind and solar have increased.
Right.
So it's maintained that same percentage. So the investment opportunity, the investment appetite, the need for continued investment in oil and gas is clearly there. But there are some in the political arena and some in financial services that are looking for ways to kind of retard that investment as we go forward. And that's
right.
That's really been damaging to what we're seeing today. And it's in large part a large part of what we're seeing today in the slow kind of response that we're having in meeting our energy challenges.
And again, we're speaking with David Holt and taking your calls. Let's go to the phones. Lillian in Sacramento is on the same exact point. Lillian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. What I was going to say is that we're not looking at the big picture of exactly what our President Biden said. He said, read my lips. I am going to end fossil fuel. But the issue is they have not kind of kept the fossil fuel and looked at other things at the same time. So they're stopping fossil fuel, and we're going crazy, for a simple
right.
way of saying.
Well put, Lillian. Well put. You know, some of us have a shorter path to get there than others, Lillian. And by that, I mean myself. But thank you very much for your call, David. It's true that this administration has come into office saying that they really wanted to put an end to fossil fuel, and that's part of the let's just say sort of the investor environment here. And if you're an investor and you're being asked to put $500 million into a platform in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, that's a thing that's going to pay off over maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years. And if the policy is to start shutting this stuff down over the next 2 or 3 years, that investment just doesn't make any sense.
You know, Lillian's point is so good, and it's really fundamental to your comment about a rational energy policy. So, you know,
right.
It's true that President Biden and many kind of on the hard progressive left, the AOCs of the world have continued to say the only way to achieve our environmental goals is to end the use of fossil energy. Well, that's either they're really not very bright or they have some other thing in mind, because there is physically no way to end the use of fossil energy. It's impossible, and we need to kind of actually stop talking about it, and it needs to end this kind of this political, philosophical conversation in this country where there are those among us that want to end fossil fuels to end to spur on our environmental improvement, and others that want to have a rational, responsible, inexpensive, reliable energy future. The point is, you can actually do both at the same time.
Right.
And having a conversation, anyone out there that is looking at a logical, rational energy policy that speaks about ending fossil energy, they need to be removed from the political discourse because, as I said, it's impossible. It's not going to happen. So the conversation needs to be, all right, we all have environmental goals. We want to reduce volatile organic compounds. We want to reduce particulate matter, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, a lot of things that are emission related to fossil energy,
right,
as well as carbon pollution. So we can continue our progress in achieving emission reductions across the board. In fact, the United States is already the leading nation on Earth in reducing emissions and improving our environment. So we're already showing we can do that at a time when we're producing more oil and more natural gas than we ever have before. So the political discussion would be, how best do we go about that? Because fossil energy is not going to end, and we need to just admit that, of those that continue to perpetuate that myth, and including the president, and talk to the American public about the best ways to achieve responsible, reliable, affordable, and environmentally friendly energy. That's the conversation. And like so many other conversations, it's so polarized in this country, we can't get there.
David, I'm going to have you hold on because we're going to have more of that conversation after the break. We're talking with David Holt, president of Consumer Energy Alliance, about a rational energy policy that will take us into the next decade and beyond. We're going to talk about demand, and we're going to talk about responsibility when we come back. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Connect with Drew on the Relevant Radio app.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, and we are in the middle of a great conversation with David Holt, president of Consumer Energy Alliance, consumerenergyalliance.org. David also founded what became HBW Resources in 2005 in order to provide counsel and guidance to companies regarding governmental and industry energy initiatives, including issues related to energy security, exploration and production, advanced technologies, air quality, and refining. Refining is a whole other issue, actually, because part of the reason why we are having this this gasoline issue is the fact that our refining capacity keeps dropping. The last time we built a new refinery was 1977 in the United States. We've expanded other refineries. We've expanded some of the refineries that are in existence, but we haven't added any capacity. And the capacity's actually fallen off because a couple of these refineries, even in the last 2 years, have just aged out and been shut down, David. So part of this is the price of oil. Part of it is production, but there's also a bottleneck here in refining and the production of gasoline itself.
You're exactly right, you know, and there's also, you know, mountains and mountains of regulations imposed by the federal government on refineries and that restrict the volume that can be produced at the refinery. So there's a lot that actually could go into it. You're exactly right. We haven't built a new refinery since the late 1970s. In fact, since I think 1982 or so, we had somewhere around 450 refineries in this country, and I think we're in the just over 100 different refineries in this country now. So it's a significant decline in the volume of refineries that we have. Now, the refineries that are there, you're right, they've expanded capability and capacity. But, you know, if there is a refinery shutdown for whatever reason in this country, it has a significant ripple effect overall on the price of gasoline and diesel. So we're you know, when you talk about that rational energy policy, we really are in many ways setting ourselves up for repeated failure because we're not permitting and building enough pipeline. We're not permitting quickly enough oil and gas development. We have a significant need for more transmission in this country and more that we can do to create a more reliable grid so we don't have right. these brownouts and blackouts. We've got to improve our refinery and infrastructure. So there's kind of in every direction you look, there's something that needs to be improved. And most of those things could be improved with a more responsible regulatory regime that allowed things to get built, that allowed permits to be issued, that allowed more consistent business predictability, which is related to the kind of the investment community right. stuff that we talked about a minute ago. So all these things are going into ratcheting down the amount, the volume of those energy molecules that we all have access to. So now if you have an extreme cold event like we had in Texas, and I'm calling you from Texas today, like we had in Texas February of last year, or we have excessively hot days in the summer, you're going to see power outages or really our inability to meet the power needs of a community. And like I said, in 2022 in America, the most energy-rich nation on earth, that to voters should be unacceptable.
Right.
We should not accept situations where our public officials, our elected officials, are creating so much regulatory red tape that we can't meet the most basic energy needs we have.
So David,
and I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat, it shouldn't matter. We should all support sensible, rational energy policy.
Absolutely. And again, we're speaking with David Holt. And let's talk about the basis of a rational energy policy. By the way, I'm coming to you from Texas, too. So I have to work that in. I have to brag about Texas a little bit here. So,
all right, Ed. We're doing something right.
I think so. I think we are, David. All right. So the basis of any policy is... any rational policy, doesn't matter if it's energy or anything else, national security, could be anything. What is it that we need now? What is it that we're going to need in 10 years, right? I mean, we're not going to stop using energy. We're not even going to be able to slow down the use of energy if we're assuming economic growth, right? I mean, there's never been a disconnect between that type of disconnect between available energy and economic growth, and we're all hoping for economic growth. Of course, our entire economy is based on the fact that we're going to have economic growth. In fact, our debt structure in the United States is based, it absolutely requires economic growth. So what do we need from energy right now, and what are we going to need in the future? So the first question here, David.
Really, you know, we need it all. So if economic right. growth means more demand, and demand is a constantly expanding balloon, right? So
right.
more demand means we're going to need more oil. We're going to need more natural gas. We're going to need more nuclear. We're going to need more solar. We're going to need more wind. We're going to need to continue to improve our energy conservation. And we're going to need to improve the environmental output from all these energy resources. And when we talk about wind and solar, we're also talking about critical minerals like cobalt and lithium and all the other mining things
exactly.
that we have to mine, that almost 100% of which we rely on China for all these critical minerals that go into our wind and solar infrastructure. And we've got to look at that from a national security perspective. So it's really how best can we meet our energy needs in an affordable one, because as you mentioned at the outset, energy impacts everything else. And when you talk about, say, the price of diesel, you're also talking about the price of food and the price of lumber and the price of clothing and the price of everything else that relies
That's
on
exactly
truck
correct.
Travel to get it to you. So affordable energy is number one. Reliable energy is number two, because those on fixed incomes, those that are unable to pay more for electricity, shouldn't be burdened with unreliable energy, right, that is intermittent, that turns off, that they're also paying more for. So you have to have energy that's reliable. The grid has to be sustainable. We're getting our energy from from sources that aren't intermittent, or if they are intermittent, and by intermittent I mean wind and solar, you have to have backup power with nuclear or natural gas that is able to quickly turn on when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining to meet those emergency needs. The third component to all this is you have to have diversity. So we want to have a diverse energy portfolio that meets energy needs in a sensible way that also protects our national security. And the last component is we have to continue to improve our environmental performance for not only energy, but all industrial practices here in the United States. That's just good corporate citizenship, right? So we want to make sure that all four of those things are being met and in a balanced, thoughtful way. And again, too many pundits, too many of our political leadership, and certainly these protesters that are out there, you know, protesting oil and gas development or pipeline expansion or permitting, they're interfering with all four of those components.
That's right.
So we've got to get past this notion that we have to pick one or the other.
David Holt, thank you so much for being with us. It's a long discussion. There's plenty more. You can go to consumerenergyalliance.org to find out more. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.